go ahead and call the Senate Resources Committee together. We have Senator Sturczewski, Senator Lassen, Senator Fanning, Senator Zaroff, Senator Coghill are present. Our schedule, basically, we set up that we would do the 191 work off the first half hour of each meeting until we could get a consensus going, and I think that Senator Sturczewski's office, Senator Fanning's office, and my office, we've been working on it. We've come up with a fairly good consensus position where we extend the board for 2 years, that we put in the requirements that there would be a fine, take out the moose, limit the name working, the name of outfitter. There's a couple other points that have to be still derived. One of them is that we're looking at putting together a task force, and the task force underneath the guise of the Legislative Council to work on and to bring back within 1 year on the 15th of January a full report on the whole problem, because it seems that we still get into some trouble with not the identification of a guide, but trying to work out what a provider of service is other than in the guiding service. And I think that this is the area that we still haven't come to a consensus on. Under the task force, we'd put 2 members from the Senate, 2 members from the House. We'd have probably 1 person from the guide board, one as a guide. The Legislative Council would appoint those 4 members of the public. They'd work under the guise of the Legislative Council, and their ex officio members would be the Fish and Game Commissioner, Commissioner of Safety, and the Commissioner of Commerce because of the licensing provision. But we're still working on that. We're going to have a work session tomorrow. We have a bill that pretty much comes to some of those consensus, but doesn't have all of the consensus in it, so I didn't want to pass that particular issue out. But we do have the member here from Fish and Game, Lou Pamplin. And Lou, you might want to come forward and just to give the committee a little overview of 5 or 10 minutes, and then we can go on to the other issues that we have before us as to how Fish and Game relates to this big game guiding program and the related services that other providers are doing in the field. Lou?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I'm glad to be here. I'm representing, of course, the Department of Fish and Game, and also for your information, the governor's office has been involved in a review of some of this, and so they're aware of the status of this at this point. First, before I get into some specific comments, and by the way, the comments I have are kind of broken in 2 parts, kind of a general comments and then some specifics on the, to tell you the truth, I've gotten a little confused on which bill we're dealing with. I think it's the one dated 2-26-88, the one you were discussing in Monday's meeting, that draft bill. There's been a little misunderstanding, I think, and some rumors floating around that the department's not interested in this, and I just want to tell you that's not correct. We are interested in it from the standpoint of how it can affect game management in the state, not from the standpoint about who's called what or what they do. That's none of our business. The other thing is that I don't know if you've looked at this legislative audit report on guiding, but there's some statements made in there by some other departments. People or other people that said the Division of Game and Department have not tried to work with the guide board, and that's not true. There's no question we need to improve communication with that board, but we're always at their service as we are any other board in this state. And so I just wanted that clear for the record and say that we'll try to do better too, if people think we aren't doing as good as we should do. I want to strongly emphasize that the department believes the guide license and control board system should be retained. And the reason for that is that it sets a reasonable regulatory framework for oversight of commercial activities associated with guiding. And it's the only structure we have in the state to do that sort of thing in terms of actual commercial utilization not looking at hunting regulations and things of that nature, but commercial utilization of wildlife. Big game guiding, air taxi operations, outfitters, whatever you call these different things, definitely influence game populations in certain areas. There's no question about that. When people go in, whether they're in a guided hunt or they're dropped off, I mean, that is hunting pressure. It's hunter effort. The numbers of people that go into areas and the distribution affects hunter harvest, hunter success. It affects game populations in terms of sex and age composition of those populations and other factors. So from that perspective, we definitely have concerns with how all of this operates. How someone wants to define these activities, those involving commercial utilization, is, again, your decision and not the Department of Fish and Game. We believe, though, that it is important from the standpoint of the public, including non-residents who come to Alaska, you know, to hunt and fish and view wildlife and many other things, that they clearly understand what the rules are and what they're going to get when they're paying for it. And the reason for this is that the image people get when they come into the state is either good or bad, whether Alaska is organized, you know, doing things that are decent for the public and all that. And when you have a lot of ambiguity or confusion, it leaves a bad taste in people's mouth, which is not good for Alaska as a state. And the other thing, and this is back to the department's position, is that when people go out, for example, and they read things in outdoor magazines or catalogs or this or that, and they see these advertisements in terms like outfitter is used or other terms, the impression they get is that they're actually dealing with a master guide, because in most states like Montana and other states, that is a term that's used to describe a guide. What happens is they come to Alaska and they think that that's what they're getting. Well, they may not be getting that. And so what do? The first thing they do is come to the Department of Fish and Game and raise all kind of hell, and we end up answering correspondence, doing this, doing that, and we're using state money to compensate for something that's unclear. And again, the people get a bad taste, and it tarnishes our image, the state and the departments, since we have no control over any of that stuff. Regarding the drafts dated 2/26/88, I have a few specific comments on that. Any reporting requirements that are placed on transporters or guides or anyone else involved in this, we believe should be similar types of reporting requirements for whatever information is to be required. That way, again, it eliminates confusion. This information is important. It's important, and by the way, we also believe that the report should go to one agency. And the way it is now, it's the Department of Commerce. And that agency would provide copies of the information as requested to the Department of Fish and Game and Public Safety, because all three agencies can receive some benefits from this information. We're opposed to the suggested change, again, in this draft report now, or draft deadline, to have the Board of Game establish regulations and/or ADF&G issue permits to guides and transporters setting limits on the amount of game their clients can take. The reason we're opposed to this is that guided hunters, just like all hunters in Alaska, are required to abide by the bag limits. And the way we manage wildlife is not on an individual, each moose, but the population. This would, if the intent, though, of this is to regulate the number of clients that guides and transporters can service during the hunting season, a permit system for us to operate would be very expensive, would probably not work because of enforcement problems and trying to figure out really who's doing what and checking up on it all the time, and is not necessary to sound management and conservation of big game populations. And that's really the strongest point from our perspective, is that, again, we look at the population status and trends, and all the harvest factors and mortality factors involved with the population dynamics of a given moose population, caribou population, or whatever. We're also opposed to the suggested head fee for several reasons on this one. First of all, hunters are already required to report to harvest, and from our perspective, that's what we're interested in. We believe that a head fee, as written in this draft bill, could encourage some abuse and improper and faulty reporting of harvest, and would further complicate our analysis of harvest data. And finally, as far as any specific comments, we're opposed to the concept of having residents report to our department information on non-residents who they take take hunting with within whatever time period, in their 21 days or any time period. Again, the reasons for opposition to that, we think it's impractical, it's unenforceable, and it would be an unnecessary burden on Alaska. I realize there are certain things that are being kind of dealt with that particular subject, but that type of requirement would cause us a lot of administrative hassle and probably wouldn't work. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll answer any questions.
Senator Penny.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lou, I appreciate you coming before the committee. I think, as you mentioned, several of the things that you specifically dealt on, I think the committee has already kind of decided that they're controversial enough that we wanted to flesh them out a little bit. I guess I'd like to ask you just about a couple things that we kind of know are before us. What is your opinion of the task force, which would include, and would the department be willing to work over the interim to help ensure that we have Fish and Game's input into a system that we think of?
Mr. Chairman, I personally think that's an excellent idea, and we'd be more than happy to participate in that and provide assistance.
So in the court, to follow up on that, Lou, in the course of your normal business, we're trying to do this without getting ourselves bogged down in a great big fiscal note. That's the reason why we want to funnel it through the legislative council so that we don't get a fiscal note hung on this bill, because that's where everything goes then. And we never know where or how it comes out. But you would be able to do this in the course of your business without having
to. Yes, sir, we do.
Because we know that we're not going to be able to solve all of the knotty problems or the gritty things on this, so the reason why we want a task force to come back by December 15th of next year is to be able to kind of address the whole issue with three departments and with the two houses and with guide industry and the whole thing.
Mr. Chair, you know, we work 20 hours a day now. That'd just be 21, so there's no problem.
Go ahead.
Well, the one thing I think of the consensus points that I think we're trying to limit it down and get something fairly simple that you did mention in your testimony that the department favors is this area of confusion, and that's the term of the use out there being prohibited relative to big game services. But I think, Mr. Chairman, most of the other things actually are comments maybe from protection that deal with violations and having everybody responsible for reporting a violation, irrespective of what category they're in. I think we all kind of agree with that. And then the field. But I don't have any further comments.
Senator Sturczulski.
Appreciate your being here, Lou. And just one question, just more for information. We haven't had a lot of involvement kind of over a period of time from your department as we sort of wrestled through this whole thing. But if you were to take a look at what's happening on there out in the field, what's the biggest pressure? Is it the people that are, how badly are we doing on our game with what's happening? One of the reasons I think we ought to take some action this year is I think just some of the advertisements and so on that are coming from outside, they're appalling. And is that starting to show up in your management in specific areas, or is it kind of statewide? How much of a concern is what's going on? How much of a concern is it to you? There's got to be a lot of violations.
Mr. Chairman, That's a real loaded question.
Well, it's a loaded
question.
But yeah.
I'll gladly try to address. I mean, what I mean by loaded is it depends, you know, on there are a lot of things that are indeed violations, whether a guy does it or a charter operator or whatever. I mean, there's things that happen. And it's not the ethical people. It's, you know, the typical thing. It's the unethical people that give everybody else kind of a bad name. In terms of actual management, the wildlife management of these populations, our normal way, again, if harvests go up or other mortality factors start, we in the Board of Game look at that population, what's going on, make recommendations, restricting seasons, shortening seasons, reducing bag limits, that sort of thing. So really the problem ends up being more of one, in many cases, of additional pressures that over time can result in reduced opportunities for people, because the more people you put into areas, you know, the more pressure there is, and the more effect it can have on the game population. There are areas in the state, from my knowledge, where additional pressure is starting to show up in the data in terms of changing, for example, the bull-cow ratios, where the number of bulls taken in an area is increasing greatly. And these are areas where, and it's not all over the state, it's certain areas, where when you go back and try to look and see what's happened, it's usually a result of increased hunting pressure, and especially, say, in the last 5 to 10 years. And so there's no doubt that that does occur in some places. And it's related to several things. In some areas, it may be the increase in number of hunters being flown in. In other areas, it may be an increase of boat utilization. I'll give you an example. That one has nothing to do with airplanes, but like over in the Susitna Valley, increase in hunting pressure, people using boats out of Anchorage. There's nothing wrong with it. I'm just saying that's what's happened, is that there's been an increase in the moose harvest. And so right along those river systems, the number of bull moose in there in the early season is diminished. The overall population, though, of that game management unit is just fine. Mm-hmm. But as far as the area where these boats are getting in, it's going down. Same thing happens in portions of interior. Planes, airplanes, boats, you name it. So it does have an effect. It occurs in many areas of the state. Those that are more accessible, though, are the ones where it's starting to increase the most. You know, for example, within an hour or two's flying time of some location. The more remote areas you get to, it's also increasing, but not near to the degree that occurs in the more centralized place.
No, tomorrow afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up on that. Lou, the relative to the most game populations are staying somewhat stable, or is that true or not true? There is more of an impact on moose than there is on caribou, for example, or sheep. Are there areas where we're having to curtail specific seasons?
Mr. Chairman, I think that the species that probably, again, the last 5 to 8 to 10 years that this is occurring more on our moose populations. However, there is more hunting pressure occurring on most of these populations, but where it could be having an effect, for example, on bull cow ratios, it's directed definitely on the moose population. Most of Alaska's larger caribou herds are increasing steadily, and you know, there's absolutely no effect on that at this point, to my knowledge, in most areas.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I want to make sure that the committee understands my answer on that. You know, we're not talking about jeopardizing the moose population when I make these remarks. What we're talking about is the number of bull moose, for example, or the overall number of moose that may be available for harvest. In other words, a biologically safe level for harvest. So we're talking really the effects in that population that can have an indirect effect on public use opportunities. That's what it's firing at.
But if that population stock goes down too far, Lou, why then you the game, the bag limit whole management area affects right across the board everybody.
For example, Mr. Chairman, we may be recommending to the board antler restrictions, you know, 36-inch antler restrictions, for example, which, no question about it, reduces the opportunities of hunting.
Senator Zoroff.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This might be off on another little tangent, but I think it's kind of important. You're with what division?
Division of Game.
Division of Game. And under a Division of Game, what do you take care of?
We're responsible for the management, conservation, research, and all other activities for wildlife in Alaska for state programs.
Good fish?
No.
Who deals with sport fish?
Mr. Chairman, the Division of Sport Fisheries.
Okay. Because I guess what I'm trying to get to here is that we've got another segment of guides out there that deals with the sport fish industry. Is that addressed anywhere?
Well, this bill is big game guide bill. So I mean, it's not the sports fish, but it was my intent to, in the letter of intent and for the instructions to the task force, that would be one of the areas that they would address.
Fish?
Sports fishing.
No. Okay, I guess under the same context, when we're We're talking about...
We're going to look at the whole district.
What people perceive as guides, you know, for example, you expect a certain degree of professionalism. But I'm a little bit concerned with the pressure that's going on the sport fishing industry. And, you know, the terms of guide out there, and I don't see any control over that whatsoever.
Well, Senator Zaroff, that you are kind of going way off the off onto a, to another area, but we know that there is a pressure. Kenai River, a good example, that there are some pressures on that. They're going to have to address it. It's not going to get addressed in the big game hunting guiding program, but we will address that. But let's get kind of keep it back on track if we can, Senator, so that I can. I have one other person to testify. If there's no other questions of Lou, I want to try and shut you off for a minute, unless you want to continue.
Well, I do, but I won't.
Is there any other questions, Lou? If there's no other questions, Lou, thank you very much, Lou. And we now have one from the Alaska Master Guide, Dennis Harness. Is that right? Harns. And I see we've got quite a few other in the audience, and we're going to go for another 10 minutes, and then I'm going to, like I say, we've got a draft coming around, and as soon as that draft is up, why, we'll distribute it, and we'll get comments, and we're going to hope to have the work session tomorrow on it, because we won't have a meeting on Friday. I'd like to have the consensus by Monday to move on it. Welcome, sir.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being able to address you. I see an extreme problem that we got. I'll try to make this short. We have a limited resource out there, particularly moose and some of the other species that are more limited. We don't have a problem with deer right now, and maybe not with caribou too much. We first have subsistence users, and we have sport hunters, the Alaskan sport hunters that are a user, and the guide board was formed in the late 60s and early 70s to try and put a cap on the commercial use of the resource. And through a lot of hard work and stuff, a cap was put on it, and it was to the tremendous advantage of the subsistence user and the residents. We did a very poor job of getting this information across to the average resident, and we've always had a few people that kind of stayed around the edges and snuck around bushes and run some illegal hunts. And about 3 years ago, they found out that they could do it under a thing called outfitting or transporting and get by with it, and it's exploded into a huge problem the last 2-3 years. And it seems like the people in the road system, they're not seeing it, but I've talked to Adams and Adlin Herman and stuff like that in the bush. They're seeing the blood out there. There's huge numbers of moose coming in by outfitters from Florida. Some of them are guides that lost their license. It costs the state $250,000 to $500,000 apiece to yank the license from some of these guys that weren't following the guide laws. And it was a terrible job. And they went into the outfitting business or transporting business. We got a heck of a problem there. Going around talking to people, I find out that communicating this very complicated problem is very difficult. But basically what's happening is there's another huge commercial user group that wants part of the action. There just isn't an infinite amount of resource out there. Now, in some cases, like in Kodiak, there's this tremendous deer population right now. Until we have a bad winter, we can probably make a special provision and allow them to do that, to use that. But basically, moose and sheep and stuff like that, there isn't any excess out there. And the people that live out in the bush, they agree totally. I noticed the people from Anchorage and Juneau and stuff, they don't agree so much, but they're not out there seeing it. And the thing is, a lot of people like to see this go away, but 2 years from now, instead of us being here, it's going to be residents here screaming and hollering, what happened to our moose? Anyway, I think that we should extend the guide board. It's been very imperfect, very much so, but it's all we got, and we've worked hard to try and make it work. It's really been a struggle to make it work. I think the present guide board is a good one, so we need to extend that. Otherwise, we'll go into total chaos. We should have a good, clean, solid definition of guiding. This outfitter, transporter, all that stuff, it's a bunch of baloney. If you take somebody from Connecticut and sell them a hunt and bring them to Alaska and get them out to some certain canyon, whether you call them a transporter, a cater, or whatever you call them, he's guiding them to that moose and he's killing a resource. He's killing an animal. Now, there are legitimate things. I'm not saying that air taxi operators that take somebody on their own that comes up here, they're legitimate. If a resident wants to take a friend out or something, that's legitimate. But the new class that's forming is the guy that goes out, or he's from outside, or a guy that's lost his license. He sells hunts to 70 caribou hunters or moose hunters and brings them up and takes that resource from the subsistence hunter and the resident and us. There isn't anything excess there. Now, however we accomplish that, I think it's very important that we do it. And this whole process of these bills and stuff gets kind of complicated and goes way over our head, but we'd sure like to have your help to save our resource.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Strzelczewski.
Appreciate your testimony, and the resource is the bottom line. I wonder if you could tell us kind of from your experience, you know, and I've seen all these advertisements, it's dreadful. Is it mainly by air that they're going, or, you know, the abuses that are happening, and there's no question but what there's a lot of it.
I tell you what's happened. Usually, up till about 3 years ago, it was kind of guys sneaking around doing it, and
how were they sneaking?
Well, I mean, they were very careful not to, you know, be very visible. But once they found out they could get away with it, actually, I think some of the biggest operations, they use air taxis to fly in. And then they take 5, 10, 15 guys in rubber rafts, they float down the Mulchatna River, they shoot everything that moves, they pull out at Stoyhawk, Ekwok, Dillingham. Mm-hmm. Those people are livid.
Yeah.
You know, they got a bunch of moose arms and some meat and stuff like that, and they're taking their winter food. They're livid, and I don't blame them. And they can come into a guide can have an area that you got 20 moose in there, you can harvest 4 a year from now to all eternity. They'll come in and wipe the thing out, and you probably took care of that for years, you know. Anyway, the interesting thing is the last 3 years, I noticed it was primarily air taxi, rubber rafts, that type of thing. I noticed last fall there was a tremendous increase in Super Cubs. There were contractors, builders and stuff that didn't have any houses to build, and they're out there on their own. I saw them buzzing around all over the place. There were a guy taking somebody else out hunting on a commercial basis. But it seems to coming from every direction. It really is increasing. Any other questions?
Yeah, Senator Finn. Yeah, just a quick one, Dennis. Just for an interest of the committee, because they might be reading some old books. Why don't you describe where your operation is? Dennis's operation is Post Lake. That's how it was.
I was very fortunate. I hunted in Arango Mountains for about 10 years, and when the D2 came down, I knew of the history of Post Lake, which is Hal Wall, which is very famous. Anyway, there's a couple of canyons there that some guys by the name of Waddell Brothers went in at the turn of the century and did some guiding. And they went by paddle wheeler up the Squintna River and took horses over through Rainy Pass and over into the Post River Valley. Anyway, in 1932, Charlie Madsen, who had been guiding from somewhere around the turn of the century on Kodiak, he took four tri-motors out of Anchorage, and he started guiding at Post Lake. He guided there for about 10 or 15 years, Charlie Madsen. He was one of the grandfather of guiding, or Kodiak bear guiding. And then one of the guys that worked for him by the name of Parker, he guided there for about 10 years. And they maintained a population through all these years. And then Hal Wall bought the improvements. He guided there for about 20 years, and it was very famous. And then when he died, Earl Stevens bought the operation from him. He guided there for 10 years. And very fortunately, during the D2 deal, I bought his improvements, and I've guided there for about 10 years. And there's a good variety of game there. You can take a small number of sheep, small number of moose, small number of caribou for infinity. But an outfitter can come in there and wipe that whole thing out in just 1 year. Just totally wipe it out. I haven't had too much problem, but I've seen it so much other places that it could happen. Long history.
Is there any other questions? I want to thank you for your presentation. It was very, very, very informative.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else here that just briefly admit it, that would like to say just a word, and then we're gonna go on to our...
Mr. Chairman, I've been calling. My name is Mark Jensen, and I haven't followed your legislation, but I have had a lot of experience. I spent 10 years as the chairman of the guide board. I don't think it's necessary to have a holdover on this whole subject. I think the real issues can be identified. They're not going to go away with a wand. And I think that that you can just name them. And I'll just like to name about five of the major issues. And if you handle those, you'll be home free. Number one, I think that you should have the big game under guiding. It's just the same as if you're a fisherman. You tell the fisherman, well, you can go out there and only catch chum salmon. You're giving the resource away. And I don't see a reason for it, to give it away. Plus the fact that you have no control of all this increase for goats, for black bear, for moose, for caribou. You're just giving it away. But there's no control over the impact of these people in any one given area. Under guiding, you have it spread out. You have good control over the take. And it makes some sense. But I don't see where it should be a big problem to put big game under guiding. It's okay. Just a logical thing to do. That's number one. Number two, the backbone of the guiding industry is to encourage good camps, to encourage good outfits. When we started hearing testimony on this whole problem, we had it going to joint use in some of the sheep area because two or three people had used it, and that was accepted. Now they have a regulation on the books that should be looked at, and that is that the board now can change boundaries under a transfer. So you're at the whim of a board. That should be correct. No legislature would set a deal up like this. You should have legislation spelling out that a transfer is going to be equal and fair to everybody, so that everybody knows where they're at. That would relieve a lot of expense on hearing officers that you're having now, a lot of court cases that you're having now, and you start cleaning this thing up. The next thing that should be looked at is the fact that they're using the game. We had game as a criteria. Our board was at the point when we left of cleaning some of these things up, but we never did it. We thought it was a good criteria, but it didn't work out for the simple reason that the Department of Game, it's impossible for them to go into a small area and say you got 10 sheep there that are full curl, so many moose and stuff like that. They can do it on a per unit basis. So you never have a set criteria that's going to be used equally for each man. Using game as a criteria for limiting a boundary or limiting an area or transferring an area. It should be taken out. The next thing is that should be looked at is your conflict of interest. You have a bunch of people out there that they're interested in one thing, improving their position. We have a regulation on the book that says that the people that are in joint use should be heard and respected, their opinions. That is wrong. Because anybody that's in there is going to try and improve their position. The board should sit and decide these things in a fair way. These are some of the things that if you just put them down, they're not going to go away if you hold it over for 1 year or 2 years. But the thing that Mr. Harm said is very important. Time is running out. Time is running out. Unless this Senate committee here and this legislature gets down to business and just tackle some of these big things right now, you're going to create more problems. Any questions?
Senator Last.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly agree with what you're saying, but the problem we're having is we press down here and something pops up over here. We press this one down and it pops up over here. So we feel like we're sort of in a box because it's like a problem that can't be fixed. But obviously it can because you have a lot of static suggestions. But you were talking about... readjusting the boundary areas. Who was doing that?
The board.
Who's
in other words, a person comes in for a transfer. The whole concept was to give stability to the guiding profession. And when you're given an area, Dick, then you know that you're going to be responsible on a conservation measure. You can build up your capital improvement. And when you get tired and old, you can transfer your area and maybe sell and get some of the money out of your capital improvement.
I guess the question is who set the areas to start with?
Well, we would hold hearings on game units.
Who set the original? Okay, the board set the areas to
start
with. Now you're saying you don't want the board to change the areas.
just follow closely. What I'm saying is that when you have a transfer, there's areas that come back to the board without a transfer. A boundary could be changed, no problem at all. What I'm saying is that something should be in the law making it clear how a transfer of your assets, if you want to call them that, can be turned over so that it's equal to everybody. And it's just that simple.
And one further question, Chairman. But when you said you're referring to big game, you're not referring just to the ones that are requires guys. I'm referring to moose and referring to deer.
I'm referring to black bear, goats, moose. I left caribou out because that's flexible as far as I'm concerned. It isn't critical. But moose is critical from the standpoint of subsistence, from the standpoint of control of where you take it. But mainly, when you look at the whole thing, why give the resource away? We're talking about non-residents that come in here and leave a few dollars. Why give it away? And if you're going to have an economy of guiding, why not put it on a stable basis like you would fishing or anything else? The time is right now, not tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mark. There was some of the guys come out of town might have wanted to say something, but we've got to go on a teleconference. We went on, we scheduled on, and we have, so we'll get back to this issue very, very shortly. Not today, but we're going to hope to have some kind of a draft worked out that we can bring before the committee. Right now, we'll go to Senate Bill 192, and we have Senator Curtula at the table, and it's an act relating to the membership of the Agriculture Revolving Loan Fund Board, and in your packet we have a letter from Commissioner Brady, and we have on teleconference Mark Weaver, who is the director of the Division of Agriculture. We're going to take up right now 192 and also 443 right afterwards. So we have a letter in the packet from Commissioner Brady. The position of the department believes that the existing ARLF board is working well but would benefit from additional expertise. However, adding members at this time in the midst of the complicated loan restructuring and asset management activities would be difficult. We support the general concept of this bill but are concerned about the timing. It should be noted there's always difficulty in selecting ARLF board members with agricultural expertise, especially at the time when numerous borrowers are having loans reviewed and the potential of conflicts of interest is high. Problems in this area have occurred in the past when producers with substantial involvement in the agriculture industry were appointed to the board. So with that, Senator Curtula, would you like to give an opening statement, and then maybe we can go and get some involvement from Mark? We're going to kind of look at these bills rapidly. We, as I understand, there's a general teleconference at 3. 3:30. Okay, so we got an hour. We got 40 minutes. Senator Curtula. No.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Resources Committee, and thank you very much for bringing up this legislation. Insofar as the concern about the restructuring group, of course, you could change the effective date the legislation does concern. However, when you go to land banks or CFAP or any of the other organizations, it's hard to imagine those organizations not having participants of the industry involved. I think conflict of interest should require any person to set themselves aside if there is a conflict with a particular board member, but most bank boards have borrowers on them, I know from personal experience. And again, the industrial sector of fishing has its members, both in processing and fishing, and the land banks and out-of-state loan agencies are all participants, are all members, as a matter of fact, of either the fishing or the farming communities, depending on what the loan program is set up for. I suggest that we have a potato farmer that's the director, and he has substantial input, or could have, on behalf of that particular segment of the industry, but we really don't have a dairyman, or grain grower, are representative of the two new development areas. And there are some people out there that are highly ethical and skilled and are not delinquent, or in fact could make a real contribution and understand subjectively the problems of the producers in those areas. And again, I wrote the present legislation. It was the result of a three-man advisory board that didn't function, increased it to a five-person board. And I believe that for geographical reasons, for reasons of needing competence on board that has the necessary information right at the fingertips and has the necessary relationship to the producer groups, that we ought to expand the board to seven, requiring two members to be participating, knowledgeable, involved farmers. Hopefully you'll find those that may not have any loans, but I'm doubtful that that would be the case, but you can find those that have no significant delinquencies or no delinquencies. But even that may not be necessary in regard to their own loans. If in fact they're involved, they should just not participate in voting or lobbying for their own particular interest, but should indeed set themselves aside as we request on the floor of the Senate or House from time to time. At least they'll be up to the committee to make that decision. Again, I see nobody specifically on the board from any of the major industries except the beef industry, which is the least substantial of the. We don't have a potato farmer, dairy farmer, grain farmer, or major vegetable farmer on the board presently. And it may have been important in the restructuring phase to bring on board a couple of lawyers and others that hopefully have some knowledge of farm programs elsewhere. But I think at this stage, we need participation of the members that are involved in actively developing agriculture. And this loan facility is probably the bulwark and basis of whatever action program the state has. Again, the various groups of farmers and the farmers themselves believe they should participate, be allowed to participate, and it was set up, and the intent to begin with was to serve farmers with farmers participating. And that's the reason I recommend that we have two user. I would envision someone in the dairy business, somebody like Harvey Bascom or somebody else out there, and really a substantial contributing, working, successful farmer out in Point McKenzie as being a member. And then I would envision probably somebody from the Delta area, or at least somebody out of the data industry to be involved. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Petula. Is there any questions of the sponsor statement? Sponsor? If not, Wylick. Senator Zara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm just a little bit concerned. Oh, sorry. I wasn't supposed to ask.
No, it's all right. It's just that going once, going twice.
Okay, I have to get in there real quick.
Take it short.
No, it will be. I see there's zero fiscal note, and it indicates also in the analysis of the fiscal note there will be an additional $8,000 a year expenditure.
It's kind of like the legislative council situation we earlier discussed. The Agriculture Revolving Loan Fund provides funding for the loan board. It doesn't come directly out of the general treasury. In fact, a good deal of the operation of the whole program comes directly out. It's one of the pre-statehood programs that was set up that has its own ability to become a revolving independent fund.
And then maybe just one other question. Are there any farmers who operate producing farms in the state that are not residents?
I don't know of a non-resident that's a major producer. I suspect there's landowners, and there may be from time to time non-residents. There's none that I know of. There are some semi-absentee by virtue of the fact that they have managers and are living in Anchorage and doing something else. I wouldn't imagine those particular people to participate on this board, though. There's a couple that own dairy farms where they are Anchorage residents. So they're Alaskan residents.
In the state.
No one that I know of is a participant. There are some that came into the area, into the Delta Grain Project, and one or two at Point McKenzie that came from out of state at the time, but they've been up there a number of years now, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years.
Okay, I guess the reason I asked that there, I was thinking there that if there were some farmers in the state that are that some farmers that operate producing farms in the state but actually didn't live in the state could conceivably end up on the board, so.
We wouldn't want that.
Right. So I was, when I was thinking, there was a possibility on line 13 before farmers, that the word Alaskan or resident farmers be included, just so that you
don't. I would subscribe to that. Right now, we don't have the problem, but as your previous testimony, it's possible that it could occur sometime or another.
But I'd leave that up to the farmers. I'm not in that business. So.
Are we going in that
business? Is there any other? We've got Mark Weaver, you know, the director, is online, and I want to get him to testify. But go ahead. If the senators want to ask the sponsor, shall we get? Let's get Mark Weaver's testimony. Mark, welcome to our teleconference on Senate Bill 192, membership of the Ag Revolving Loan Fund.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I missed a few of the comments. I got most of them. If there's something that I need to hear, it helps to people can speak into the microphones. I think the problem is that sometimes you're not quite close enough for the machine to pick it up. Did you want me to amplify on anything in particular, or just I can make a general statement if that would be helpful?
That's what I think, Mark. Why don't you just make a general statement, and then if any of the senators have a question of you, if not, why, then we can go to general comments, and if there's something that you see that you would like to comment on as we go down the hearing on this, why, just write them down, and then we'll come back to you.
Thank you. The point that I think I would like to make more than anything else is that the concern expressed by the department in its position letter from the commissioner has more to do with timing than with the than any criticism of the merits of the bill. I share concern that the loan board needs expertise. The members of the loan board have the same feeling. They are always looking for ways of getting more expertise, and a very good way of doing that is to broaden the membership with a careful selection process. The only the point that the department was trying to make was that we didn't want to raise expectations that we wanted to run out immediately and go through a selection process and have new board members coming online right away. The difficulty is just that there is an unusually large amount of activity with the loan board right now. The members are putting in much more than the ordinary time that should be required because of the financial difficulties that have stricken our industry along with the industry in the whole United States. This has led to a fairly complicated restructuring process, which we're feeling our way through, I think, with some success at this point. I would expect that situation, though, to change in the foreseeable future. We hope to have our restructuring work essentially completed by operating time this spring, which is only now a couple of months away. And there will clearly be some cleanup work that we would expect the breathing space beginning sometime this summer. And at that point, which probably isn't very far away, the bill begins to look very attractive as a way of getting more expertise onto the board.
Any questions of Mark? Senator Fisher?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, do you have a high degree of absenteeism among the board members?
I don't think we've had any absenteeism in the last 8 months. There's been too much work to do.
I guess the reason I ask that is in Charles Pork's evaluation of the bill, he's saying that a seven-man board or seven-member board increases from 3 to 4 the number of members that must be present. And that's what indicated to me that there must be a problem with people showing up. But if there isn't, then this would go the other way. Would it not? It would guarantee. Now you have 2 more members that have the chance of being there. So if only one shows, you're pretty well off, aren't you?
Well, I agree with your view. And unfortunately, Speaking of absenteeism, I had to miss the meeting at which this bill was discussed, so we didn't have a good discussion of it, and if you have to second guess the bill a little bit, what their concerns are, as I understand them, is not the addition of new board members. They were just up to their ears and alligators, and because breaking in a new board member does take some time, they were concerned that if this was going to be dumped on them right away, particularly right now, it would not be helpful just because of the urgency of getting some of these loans straightened out before we go into the operating loan season that's coming upon us. But in reality, this bill probably won't take effect till this summer anyway if it's passed. I don't think that's going to be nearly so much concern then. I think the board was just overreacting and in the middle of making loan decisions when they thought about it, and perhaps didn't think it through all the way.
Mark, then can we also assume that there's an overreaction to the statement that says that right now we have an already overburdened loan fund staff? What I'm getting at is this letter also maintains that the staff is already overburdened, and that if we put two more members on, it's going to cause more staff time and more of this. And I guess my question is, are we talking a larger fiscal note than the $8,000?
Did you get that question, Mark?
Senator, I'm sorry, I haven't heard anything since I finished.
Okay. Well, you blew the fuse out here, so we're now, I'm going to move my mic over so that Senator Fisher can
Thanks, Mark. We have a one of the reasons why you do not want to increase the board to seven is the comment that already we have an overburdened staff, which would imply that if we add two more members, we're going to have to add also additional staff members. I'm just wondering if that's not a overreaction, a statement like that.
Yeah, I think it is. It really means that we have to turn the copying machine on for another 5 minutes to copy the materials. It's not really a significant burden. There would be some travel expenditures and per diem, but actually those don't amount to a whole lot. It's certainly not going to significantly affect the operating budget of the loan fund.
Thanks.
Senator Tertulla.
Mark, I hope you can hear from this microphone. The effective date change would alleviate the consternation. I know this was a concern a year ago, so we kind of left it sit. It still seems to be a concern, and you're nearing completion of some important decisions, and then I suspect it's the next step in having a look at agriculture and making decisions on new loans and so on. Seems to me that a December 1 or some other effective date ought to cover the problem of any confusion now or bringing people up to speed until you've finished the restructuring. And that would satisfy, I think, the varying segments that are interested in participating. Just have an effective date.
I agree with that assessment.
Have you, Mark, received a copy of the letter from Charles Fork, your chairman of the Agricultural Revolving Loan Board, that gives many, many reasons why this thing should not go forward? Have you read that? Have you taken any direction from that?
I have read it, Mr. Chairman. I not only think I have a somewhat different opinion, but I also happen to think that if we had discussed the bill and talked about timing as opposed to the merits, the letter might not have been quite in the same tone. I really think the loan board was not thinking it through, but just saying, this is not a good time to be changing the board makeup. We've got too much work to do to think about it for the next few months. I really think that beginning towards the end of summer or fall, things are going to look a whole lot different.
Senator Lassen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, I'm just reading the article you wrote in Anchor's Daily News, 24th November, over a year ago. And I do appreciate some of the things you're saying. For instance, easy farm credit too often rewards bad management. It does not produce private sector growth that is substantially and unsubsidized. Lesson two, to encourage agricultural production for its own sake is foolishness. Supply must be driven by demand. And number three, farmers must be required to bear the ordinary risks of doing business. Farming may be different from other businesses, but it's not special. I think we all sort of, at least I agree with that, with those lessons. But however, we have a letter here from, which is supporting, information which is supporting the bill. It says, in effect, it quotes your article, the letter, the bill, as I understand it, adds two more members to the board, and they're farmers. And it quotes your article as saying, in effect, that credit, talking about credit to farmers, and you say, they do need a bank they can rely on, and this is most important, a banker who knows farming and who knows a potential profitable operation from a losing one. Now, my interpretation is that you're saying someone that is totally knowledgeable of banking activities and also knows farming, and the bill itself says we're going to put two more farmers on, so, and he's quoting your article here. Now, what do you mean by that statement?
Well, I think that you have to have a combination of expertise to run a good loan program. You have to have good banking sense. The problem that I sense when you only have good banking sense is that in this state in particular, it's very hard to get agricultural expertise along with it. And you need to have both of those things to know a good risk from a bad risk when it comes to making a farm loan. It is fairly easy to overreact to the credit problems that we have had in the past, I think, by saying either no loans will go out, or if they can't convince a banker, then forget about it. But the trouble is that we don't have very many bankers that really know much about farming. And I've watched this new board now. They're all the members on this board have been in office less than a year. I've watched them work since they were appointed last spring, and my sense is that there is a very healthy dialogue between commercial concerns, banking concerns, and at least two of the board, current board members have significant commercial loan experience. There's a very healthy dialogue between that and the people on the board who know something about agriculture, and I think that has contributed to good decisions, by and large, very good decisions. So, I guess, looking back at the article I wrote, which I'm still fairly happy with in terms of my position, I would say that too, credit that is too easy is not healthy for any industry. But you do have to have somebody in the banking industry that the farming industry can go to who will understand their particular problem. I think that having a board with agricultural expertise on it, that practical, real, very fingernail expertise is very useful. I would not want to see everybody on that board be farmers. I think you have to have a mix.
Not quite clear what you really said, except that I assume then that it's just as important to have a farmer who understands economics as is that the banker who understands agriculture on the board. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I believe that's correct. And that actually you get the farmer will see things that the banker does not see, and vice versa. And because our state is so diverse geographically, because the climate in Delta is different from the climate in the Map 2, and that's different from the climate on the Kenai, it does help to have some geographic distribution of farmers, and it also helps to have a variety of commodity groups represented in the farmer seats on that board.
Thank you.
Senator Fisher.
Mark, you had indicated that all the members have less than a year on the board, and if the board is appointed for staggered terms, 3 years and 2 years, how come we don't have people that are that have the 2 or 3 years of experience?
Well, Senator, the simple answer is that when I took office, the last board resigned, and the reason that they resigned, at least part of the reason was that I had a philosophical approach that they didn't agree with. And they offered me the resignations, and they basically took the position that this administration could accept those resignations, and it did.
Okay, no, Mike, I was curious because I know one of the people that did resign was a banker, which I thought that, you know, we should keep a banker on the board.
And he talked to us.
I agreed with that. I mean, that was my position at the time. What became apparent to me was that the we worked through the problem. We were without a board for several weeks. There were so many personality associations that had historically developed over time that after some serious thinking, I elected to make a clean break. You should know that one of the people that's on the board now, although he is not a banker, he has a larger than a business degree, and he earns his living working with bankers and solving their loan problems for them as their attorney. So we have an unusual amount of commercial lending experience in that person. And frankly, I agree with your assessment that you need somebody like that on the board. But we do have it. We also have another a public member who has
okay. Is there any other questions of Mr. Weaver? All right. Is there any questions of the sponsor, Senator Cotullo?
I don't have any further questions.
Any further questions? Could we possibly, with the...
You're not going to ask yourself any questions?
Yeah, Senator Cotullo, could we possibly maybe take put an effective date on this where that we would say make it January 1 of next year? That would get through the whole process of the restructuring, would take away Charlie Burke's biggest objections.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a good idea. I think the effective date covers the problems. In the meantime, there's also the opportunity to kind of select and suggest from the farmers groups and so on who might well be the one that should serve from each commodity. Mm-hmm.
Senator,
I have one question.
Senator Lassen?
I know I'm digging in a field I don't understand too well.
Yep, sir.
Well, I'm sure that he was
smelly.
This is your area, of course. I'm sure you probably considered the plus and minuses of requiring at least one banker on the board. They don't require that. Isn't that as important as having a farmer on there? I don't know. I mean, it's just a question that I suppose you looked at.
As a matter of fact, we've always had a banker on the board until recently, and I guess the way that I kind of thought the way the board was composed, that was a request to have somebody with at least banking experience on the board. I can't remember exactly, but it was my intention. You do have a problem, and that is you really like to have a resource banker, if possible. And there are a few in this state. There one that's served on CFI board. There's over, I think, Alaska Mutual. There's two or three. One came out of Kenai. There's a couple that have worked in California, you know, in ag loans with Bank of America. It's possible, and I think that's legitimate to suggest and also to recommend. Right now, though, I think we have mostly out of the business community, lawyers and so on. And probably in restructuring was all right because they had some business experience.
Well, you don't have
to. We always have that.
So you, what you're saying is that you'd like to go ahead and restructure this then to put in a resource banker?
I have any objection to that. My main concern, Senator, is to get participating farmers that are people of substance, are contributing, and have some experience in their various areas on the board. So I'm really just speaking to putting the two farmers on myself. but the senator asked me why there shouldn't be a banker, and my memory is that
you require that on CFAP now, don't you?
I don't know if we do or not, but my memory is that if you read the present board structure, that there's an indication that they want people with that kind of background already.
Okay, we'll hold the bill and get
Mr. Chairman, couldn't we
move a CS?
Move a CS with
effective date January 1 and
put a resident permanent.
Put a
resident.
Yes, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I hope I don't appear to be harassing anybody, but don't you think it'd be proper to also put a public disclosure clause in this for the board itself?
I believe there already is, isn't there?
I didn't find it in the statute.
About the open meeting?
That's already, no, they have that in there, but it's got a closed. But I mean, if they're going to close the meeting, they should open up their, if they're dealing with loans, I think maybe it's proper to have a disclosure.
Have any objection?
Well, isn't that a part of the statute now?
I think it is.
I couldn't find it.
Can you, Mark, address that? Aren't the members of the Ag Revolving Loan Board already required to public disclosure?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I didn't quite hear the whole question.
Is it not right now the duty of the people that go on the Ag Revolving Loan Board, aren't they required to do public disclosure?
Yes, they all, in fact, they have to fill out the APOC form. And also, we have an internal guideline that helps us to resolve any conflict of interest that's been developed with the help of the Attorney General's office. So that, there's not only an APOC screening, but there's every board meeting, any potential for conflict is brought to the attention of the chairman and is dealt with before the loan occurs.
Is there any other question? That answer your question, Senator Lassen?
Answer my question.
Okay, then if there's no objection, I'm ready for a motion.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Sturgeluski?
I would move for adoption of committee substitute for Senate Bill number 192 with putting on an effective date of January 1, 1989.
Put resident in there.
And add the word resident on line 13 between B and farmers, and ask unanimous consent.
Is there any objection? No objection, it's so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the bill with individual recommendations and ask unanimous consent.
You've heard the motion to move the bill. The unanimous consent has been asked. Is there any objection? No objection, it's so ordered. And so, Senate Bill 192 is moved from the Resources Committee with individual recommendations.
Thanks for coming to our table.
Appreciate your support as a guide.
I'm glad you're here to take part.
I'm going to make somebody else suffer for this.
Look at this game.
Okay, we're going to go to the next order of business.
Which is what?
The next order of business is Senate Bill 443, which is relating to game bird farming. Game bird farming, and it's Senate Bill 443.
Let's don't have any grousing about this one, okay?
We have four.
Are we still on teleconference?
We're on teleconference. We have four sites on location. We have. Kodiak people have already gone offline when that Senator will still. What this bill has to do with, it's quite Senator has to do with raising grouse in captivity. We understand that now it's not designated as a domestic bird, and the department may issue a game bird farming license for farmers of grouse to a person who applies on a form provided by the department, pays a fee, intent to raise for breed grouse, and possesses facilities for maintaining the grouse under positive control so that it doesn't get into the wild stock, as I understand it. We have online Mr. Ken Brevard from Wasilla. And Ken, can you hear us? Is Wasilla on? Beth? Is Wasilla on? Is there anybody on the line?
Can you hear us, Senator Coghill?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. Mr. Rivard did respond. Did you hear him?
No, we didn't hear anybody. Would he please continue? Would he please restate his statement? We didn't hear anybody.
Yes, sir. Senator Coghill, this is Mr. Rivard. Ken Rivard.
Would you go ahead and give your statement, please, to the committee?
Okay. The statement I have is basically in the letters that we sent down on the fax machine yesterday. We're in support of the bill to raise grouse as it is stated. We've done a lot of research. We cannot come up with any disease problems or hybridization problems.
Is there any questions of Mr. Kent? Yes, Senator Fanning.
Thank you, Mr. Vard. When you mean it, you can't come up with any disease problems or hybridization problems. Could you give me an idea of what that means? Have you done it? Has somebody done some extensive research?
Okay, Senator Coghill and Senator Fanning, the birds that we have raised in captivity up here in Alaska, when we have a bird that does die, we have a necropsy, or sometimes it's called an autopsy. And we had not found any disease of the birds so far that we have had this performed on.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, and there have been attempts that have failed at crossing those birds with that you're dealing with all of the types of wild birds in Alaska?
There are no deliberate attempts that we are aware of trying to cross with any sort of grouse. Aviculturists, which we are, strongly discourage crossbreeding of any species of bird or animal.
Okay, thanks. But then we don't know if it will have that impact with the wild stock.
Go ahead. Senator Fisher, try that one. See if it works.
Can you hear? So.
Yes, I can hear it.
Go ahead. Ken, the question I have, we're not talking about letting these birds out, right? They're going to be in that captivity from the birth to the death, right?
Yes, Senator Coghill, to the best of our knowledge, we do not intend to release these birds. We met with the game board in 1987, and we amended 5AAC 92.028 and came up with agriculture permits that has the requirements to apply for a permit when you want to raise grouse from the Department of Fish and Game. And one of the requirements is you will keep your birds wing-clipped to prevent just the problem we speak of escaping into the wild.
Go ahead. Senator Fanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one other question. I understand that those who receive permits would, of course, keeping them penned, but the permit would be for the purpose of selling the birds, and I don't see anything in here about death. In fact, it specifically talks about selling chicks, so I would assume that others would have the ability, who are not the people who are issued the permits, to have the birds. Is that not the intent of the legislation, or is that a mistake on my part?
Senator Coghill and Senator Fanning, you cannot have a permit to raise grouse
or you cannot raise grouse of any species without a permit from the Department of Fish and Game. This legislation, Bill 443, would fall under that criteria. You have to have your facilities inspected, permit is issued to the point that you intend, as it says, to raise or breed grouse. We do not intend to raise them to be released into the wild.
But you could sell the offspring.
Yes, this is correct. And the reason you'd like to have the ability to sell or dispose of the offspring is it costs a lot of money to build facilities, pens, housing, feed, and your time and effort. And it would be nice to recoup some of the expenses that you incur in this aviculture pursuit.
Senator Duncan.
Chair, I don't know anything about grouse farming. Are you raising this to make a profit? Are you farming these birds to make a profit? Do you sell them for eating purposes? Or do people get them because they like to have them as pets? What is the whole thing about bird farming? What's the purpose behind it?
Well, Senator Coghill, the purpose behind this is aviculturists throughout the world raise different species of birds to have a captive bred population in event something would happen in the wild. But those of us that pursue this aviculture pursuit raise different species, and grouse is just one of the many that we do raise. They raise pheasants, they raise cranes, they raise geese and swans and ducks and golden eyes and golden bills, golden eye ducks. We do not sell the bird for meat. They're very valuable birds in a person's pen. And it takes a lot of time and effort to raise them up and to breed them. And we're also doing study and research on grouse, particularly because there are not many grouse on display to the public because they're very difficult to keep in captivity, especially the ptarmigan part.
Two others on here that I'd like to get them to testify.
It's kind of like art, I guess.
Thank you, Ken. We've got just exactly 2 minutes, and then we're going to have to go to Linda Bellinger, who is there in Wasilla with you, and then we've got one person in Hope. Then we can take on we'll take fish and game testimony here. But we're going to have to go off the bridge at 3:30. So, Linda, would you give us your testimony?
Good afternoon, Senator Coghill, senators, many others I am not aware who are attending the conference. I'd like to take this opportunity to speak in behalf of the Alaska Game Bird Association in support of Senate Bill 443. I have prepared a lengthy statement, but I think I'll just cut it down and give you an idea of what I've been working on the past 4 or 5 days, which has been to contact the different state offices and departments that are in Alaska and get an idea on what insect problems or disease problems may be pertinent to the raising of grouse in Alaska. I've spoken with Ed Holston, entomologist with the Division of Forestries, the Anchorage office. He's an insect specialist. And he's told me that there are no known disease-carrying mosquitoes or black fly populations in Alaska at this time. Probably have 4 to 5 different mosquito genera and 6 black fly populations. With the Cooperative Extension Service in Palmer, I've spoken with Meg Burgess, who's never heard of any problems as far as disease-carrying mosquitoes or flies. She's also an aviculturist and has extensively raised poultry herself. With Dick Barrett, the state pathologist, Department of Environmental Conservation in the Palmer office. As far as he knows, the black fly or mosquito populations, there have been no known disease transmissions that they can substantiate or put their hands on. With the Julie Riley, horticulturist with the University of Alaska Extension Service in Anchorage, no documented evidence at this time concerning disease transmission of grouse or any other upland game birds existing in Alaska, nor any evidence of disease spread by insects. With Mr. Don Ritter, who is the manager of the North Region Lab, he's in charge of disease, both bacterial and viral, for the state of Alaska at the University of Fairbanks. And at the moment, he's doing a library research for me. They have quite an extensive Avian Library there in Fairbanks. He did call me this morning and said that...
Linda, can you hear me?
What he's found so far, there is no documented evidence in the state of Alaska. What would turn up would possibly be diseases of migratory waterfowl, but nothing for upland game birds, which would be the ground in the state of Alaska. Also, with Kim Creek, University of Alaska Extension Service, he stated this morning over the phone that in theory the possibility of disease transmission by insect vectors in the state is feasible, but there is no documented evidence to back up that theory. This is generally what I've been working on, trying to go to the State Department, speak to experts to back up or persuade our opinion on Senate Bill 442.
We'll have a meeting Friday and I'll have the schedule. Are you, Linda, can you read me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, what where the bridge is telling us we got to go off. I'm going to continue this. We're going to come back online Friday afternoon at 1:30. We're going to continue this bill because we want to get some questions. We want to get the fishing game. We got Mr. Twait in at Hope. We're out of time. We can't. We've got committees that we've lost most of our committee members because they've got other obligations. So we're going to go off the line because the teleconference bridge has got to go to a full teleconference program at 3:30. So we'll see you all at 1:30 on Friday if you can make it back.
Thank you, Senator Cogdill.
All right, we're adjourned.